She ran barefoot through the marsh, screaming they were trying to kill her, and no one came. Over a decade later, more than 11 sets of remains were discovered along the same cursed stretch of Long Island's coast, each woman with a life, a voice, and a story that was silenced. This is not just about a serial killer. This is about a system designed to ignore the most vulnerable. I'm your narrator, and over the next 6 chapters, you'll hear the true crime stories they tried to erase. From offshore accounts to red tape, from burlap-wrapped horror to whispered 911 calls, no one answered. This is the story of the Long Island serial killer's victims. And this time, we speak their names. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The night Shannon ran. They say screams don't carry far in the marshlands, but I still hear hers. I wasn't there that night, May 1st. Omtiteni, but I've replayed it in my head more times than I can count. I've studied the maps, heard the 911 call, walked the cracked pavement of Oak Beach until my boots were soaked in seawater and truth. I know where her sandals were found. I've touched the spot where her phone was last pinged, and I've spoken to the people who heard her cries and did nothing. My name is Jacob Reed. I'm not a cop. I'm not a detective. I'm a former crime reporter who never quite made peace with the cases that stayed open. This one stuck to me like smoke. Shannon Gilbert wasn't supposed to be famous. She was supposed to be forgotten. That was the design. This system, makes girls like her invisible. But Shannon didn't go quietly. She ran into the night, screaming for help, and someone listened. Just not the people who should have. She was 23, beautiful in the way tragedy is beautiful, bright-eyed, full of too many dreams in a world designed to eat them alive. An escort by profession. But that label never sat right with me. She was also a sister, a daughter, a fighter. She grew up in Ellenville, a small town upstate where poverty wasn't a statistic. It was a legacy. She'd been diagnosed bipolar. That's what her records say. But I don't think it was her diagnosis that made her vulnerable. It was the damn bureaucracy, the red tape, the system that gave her meds without context, labels without support. They didn't treat her like a woman trying to live. They treated her like a problem to be managed. By 2010, she was living in Jersey City with a boyfriend slash manager. That night, she took a call from a client in Oak Beach, Long Island. It was a gated community, wealthy, secluded, surrounded by marshes that swallowed sound. He paid for her to come out there, and she did, just like she had a dozen times before. But this time, something went wrong. According to the official timeline, Shannon arrived just before 2 a.m. Her driver, Michael Pack, waited outside in the car while she went in. What happened inside that house is a fog of contradictions. Some say she panicked over nothing. Others say she was drugged, threatened, chased. What we know is this: by 4:51 a.m., she was on the phone with 911, hysterical, begging for help. She screamed, "They're trying to kill me," over and over. The call lasted 23 minutes. Police never showed up. That call was buried under paperwork for over a year. Let me tell you something about red tape. It's not just an obstacle. It's a weapon, the kind that kills people slowly, invisibly. It delayed that call. It delayed the search. It let the silence grow thicker, deadlier. Shannon ran from the house that night, barefoot. She pounded on doors. She begged strangers to help. They didn't. Some ignored her. One man even told her to stop making noise. She disappeared into the marsh. Her body wasn't found until December of the next year, but her death cracked open a nightmare. While police were searching for Shannon, they found something else. A series of burlap-wrapped bodies, spaced like morbid breadcrumbs along Ocean Parkway. Women, all sex workers, all disappeared within a 5-year window. Maureen, Melissa, Megan, Amber, each one a ghost waiting to be uncovered. Shannon wasn't among them. Not at first. When they finally found her, she was half a mile away in a reed-choked patch of swamp. No burlap, just bones, clothes, and heartbreak. The medical examiner called it accidental drowning, but her mother never believed that. And neither do I, because there were too many damn coincidences. Her necklace was broken. Her shoes were found far apart. Her purse still had her phone inside, untouched. She wasn't some drugged out girl who got lost. She was running from something or someone. And when the system failed to catch her cries, she vanished into the shadows of justice. Years passed. Lawsuits were filed. Protests came and went. Her mother fought like hell to reopen the case, even hired a private pathologist who found signs of possible strangulation. But it didn't matter. The story was too messy. The media moved on. The bureaucracy won. Until 2023, Rex Heuermann, architect, father, Gilgo Beach suspect. When they arrested him, the headlines roared. The man who lived in Massapequa Park was charged with multiple murders tied to the very same bodies found while searching for Shannon. But Shannon's case was still separate, still undetermined, still conveniently unclassified. That's what this podcast is about. Not just the killings, but the erasure. The way justice is rationed based on social status. The way financial corruption seeps into the foundation of law enforcement. How women like Shannon are turned into footnotes while the sinister cases that orbit them remain unfinished. You'll hear me say her name a lot. Shannon Gilbert. She wasn't perfect. She was complicated. Real. Human. And her last act on this earth was to scream for help while no one came. That haunts me. Not because I think she could have been saved, but because I think she should have been. And if you're listening to this, it means there's still time to pull her out of the silence. The next voice you hear will be mine, recounting another name, another victim, another justice tale left unfinished. Until then, remember, sometimes the scariest part of a true crime story is how true it really is. Maureen's last call, I never heard her voice, not in person, but I've memorized her phone records. I've sat across from her sister, Sarah, and listened to stories most people wouldn't have the stomach for. I've walked the same sidewalks in Norwich, Connecticut, where she used to hustle freelance gigs just to keep the lights on. Maureen Brainard Barnes, she was the first known Gilgo victim and the first to be buried under red tape. But to me, she wasn't just the beginning of a serial killer's archive. She was a warning ignored, discarded, and ultimately silenced. I found her story in a folder marked Unsolved Escorts. It was gathering dust. No one was asking the right questions. She was 25 years old, a single mom with two kids. Her son had just turned 6. Her daughter was barely out of diapers. She wasn't some reckless thrill seeker. She was a woman caught between poverty and bureaucracy, trying to scrape together enough money to keep her family fed while dodging judgment at every turn. Before escorting, she worked telemarketing, retail. She even tried bookstagram-style side hustles, selling used novels from flea markets online, reading thrillers in her bathroom during the few quiet hours. She had a thing for stories about justice. The irony cuts deep now. In early July 2007, Maureen told her family she had a modeling gig in Manhattan. That was a partial truth. She'd answered an ad, took a bus into the city, checked into a cheap motel, and then she disappeared. Her phone went dead. Her bank account stopped moving. Her children abandoned, but not by choice. Sarah filed the report within 48 hours. Police told her Maureen was probably just on a break, said it was common with girls like that. Girls like that. There's a specific tone they use when they say it, like it justifies forgetting someone. Weeks passed. Nothing. No surveillance footage. No hotel checkout. No witnesses. Just static. I've traced the call logs. The last known ping was in Midtown Manhattan, near 33rd Street. But by the time anyone took it seriously, Maureen had been missing for 5 months. It wasn't until December 2010, 3 years later, that her remains were found on the side of Ocean Parkway in Gilgo Beach. She was wrapped in burlap, carefully positioned, discarded like evidence in a crime no one wanted to solve. The forensics were grim. She had been strangled. No sign of a struggle, which usually means she was overpowered or drugged. There were no signs of robbery, Her personal effects were gone, but her jewelry was still with her. That's rare. I think he kept it as a trophy. I won't say his name yet. Not now. He doesn't deserve center stage in her chapter. Here's what makes Maureen's story sting. Her family kept calling the Suffolk County Police for updates, and they got nothing. For years, her case was marked as inactive, buried under budget constraints and bureaucratic delays. That's the thing about financial corruption. It doesn't always look like cash in hand. Sometimes it's silence. Sometimes it's decisions made by overworked detectives who are told to prioritize cases with political value. And Maureen, she was a woman who lived paycheck to paycheck, who used offshore accounts to protect what little she made from the men who exploited her, who trusted a broken system to find her if something went wrong. It didn't. Sarah tried everything. She talked to news anchors, posted in forums. She even published a few justice tales of her own. Blogs, Reddit posts, podcasts. She'd say her sister didn't deserve the ending she got. And she was right. But Maureen's name never got national traction, not like others. Because she didn't die with a headline, she disappeared into shadows of justice. I remember the first time I visited her old apartment. The lease had long been expired, the building nearly condemned. But the landlord let me inside, just to see it. There were old books left behind, a curling photograph of her kids on the wall, a post-it on the fridge that said, "Remember the groceries Thursday?" It hit me like a sucker punch. She wasn't just a file. She wasn't missing female Mo 1. She was a woman who had plans, lists, groceries. She was supposed to come back. I often wonder what her last night looked like. Did she realize she'd made a mistake? Did she think it would be just another client? Was it the same man who would later be charged in Amber Lynn Costello's murder? Was it Rex Hoyerman? There's speculation. Similar M. Oh, same region. Same method. But no one's confirmed it. On Suffolk PD, they're not rushing to unveil anything that might lead to more true crime stories about their failures. This isn't just a story about a serial killer. It's a story about systems that make serial killers possible. Systems where certain women are disposable. Where financial scams matter more than human lives. Where cops look the other way when the victim doesn't fit the press release. If you remember anything from this chapter, remember this. Maureen called home 2 days before she vanished. She told her sister, "I'll be back in time to take the kids to the lake." She never made it, and no one went looking until it was too late. In the next episode, we'll talk about Melissa Barthelemy, the woman whose little sister got phone calls from her killer. The man on the other end laughed, whispered, described what he did, and the police didn't trace the call. But that's next time. For now, I'll leave you with the one thing the system didn't give Maureen. A voice. The calls that tore a family apart. I never used to believe in evil, not the way movies frame it. I thought people were broken, not born bad. But after what I learned about Melissa Barthelemy, I'm not so sure anymore. What kind of person calls a grieving family to describe how he murdered their daughter? What kind of monster taunts a child with her sister's death? I've sat across from victims. I've interviewed inmates. I've documented sinister cases. But this is something else entirely. This is psychological warfare from a ghost wearing a human face. Melissa Barthelemy was 24, originally from Buffalo, a licensed cosmetologist who wanted to open her own salon. She moved to the Bronx, chasing that dream, doing hair in apartment kitchens, juggling rent, and slipping into escort work when the bills wouldn't wait. She didn't advertise recklessly. She wasn't careless, but she was alone. On July 10th, 2009, she told her roommate she had a client, a man, said she'd be back later that night. She never came home. I retraced that night. I walked from her old building to the subway, down to the spot in Manhattan where her phone last pinged. Midtown again. Always Midtown. It's the predator's comfort zone, crowded, anonymous, filled with women looking to survive another day. She met the client, got into a car. After that, silence, until the phone rang. It started a week later. Amanda, Melissa's little sister, was only 15 when she got the first call. She was at home with her mom in Buffalo. The phone lit up with Melissa's number. "Melissa?" she answered, breathless. But it wasn't her. It was a man. His voice was low, calm, almost polite. And then he said, "Is this Amanda?" She said, "Yes." "I killed your sister." He hung up. It didn't stop there. He called again. And again, for weeks. Each time, more disturbing, more graphic, he described sexual acts. He mocked Melissa's last moments. He told Amanda she was next. The FBI got involved. The NYPD tapped the phone. They traced the signal to Times Square, but the calls were too short. The area too dense. He slipped through the cracks. Red tape, again. That's what kills me. They had enough to treat this like a high-level threat. A man calling from crowded public spaces to torture a family. This should have triggered a national manhunt. But they labeled Melissa high-risk lifestyle, which is code for don't expect much. Her case stalled. Her mother, Lynn, begged for answers. Amanda fell into a depression that still echoes through her adult life. Their grief was raw, public, and completely unsupported, and the killer kept watching. He knew when they were alone. He knew when Amanda picked up the phone. He fed off their helplessness. That's not random. That's ritualistic cruelty. In December 2010, Melissa's body was found wrapped in burlap off Ocean Parkway. Gilgo Beach, same pattern, same method as Maureen, Megan, and Amber. Her cause of death was strangulation. Her remains were intact, but weathered, dumped long before the discovery. Like the others, there were no signs of robbery, just a calculated disposal. But Melissa's story is unique, because her killer reached back into the world after the crime. He didn't just kill her. He used her voice to kill her family, too. I've read the full transcript of those phone calls. They're sealed. But I pulled favors. They're the kind of thing that sticks to your spine. Here's what the killer said in one. "Do you miss her?" I made her beg. I made her say your name. Amanda was 15. Let that sink in. Now ask yourself, why didn't the system respond with urgency? The answer is bureaucracy. The slow poison of indecision. Interagency egos. Financial crimes get fast-tracked because they threaten the elite. But when it's a girl from the Bronx, a working-class family, and a case full of red tape, it rots. The justice system has cracks. And predators like this one, they live in those cracks. By 2011, after the discovery of Melissa and the others, public pressure mounted. But Suffolk County PD resisted external help. There were whispers of corruption, internal mismanagement, even rumors that the killer may have had connections inside the force. I don't deal in rumors, but I do follow patterns. And what I saw here was a pattern of suppression. They hid the 911 call logs. They delayed the FBI's access. They filtered every statement through PR advisors, like they were guarding offshore accounts, not lives. This wasn't about solving the case. It was about controlling the fallout. Even today, Melissa's killer hasn't been officially confirmed. Rex Hoyerman is the suspect for Maureen, Megan, and Amber, but not Melissa. Not yet. Why? Because her case is complicated. The phone calls create a trail the system never properly followed. Following it now would mean admitting they botched it from the beginning. And no one wants that headline. Amanda never got justice. She got voicemails from a ghost. Her sister's death became a true story no one wants to retell. Not because it's too graphic, but because it's too revealing. Melissa Barthelemy exposes the lie. The lie that if you scream loud enough, someone will help you. That the law will protect you. That families get closure. Some don't. Some are left to unravel alone. The next chapter takes us to Maine. A young mother. A hotel lobby camera. A final cigarette. Her name was Megan Waterman. And her disappearance led to the break no one saw coming. But before that, let Melissa's voice echo a little longer. Because what happened to her family isn't just horror. It's a reflection. A mirror held up to a broken justice system. A shadow we all try not to see. Megan's last room key. She was just 22 years old. A mother. A daughter. And in the cold silence of a Long Island motel corridor, she became another name the world would ignore. Megan Waterman wasn't born into crime. She was born into circumstance. That's how these stories start more often than people like to admit. Not with monsters or secrets, but need. And that's what brought her here, to the dark edge of Haupog, New York, to a last hotel key, to the last night of her life. Megan was from Scarborough, minor. She had a daughter, tiny, bright-eyed, barely out of toddlerhood. Her daughter was her anchor. Everything Megan did, even the stuff she never wanted to talk about, was for her. She grew up fast, too fast. Childhood blurred into responsibility, and when bills mounted, Megan crossed a line that so many women are forced toward, not out of recklessness, but out of desperation. She started escorting, quietly, anonymously. But there's no such thing as anonymous in this business, especially when predators are watching. On June 5th, Megan checked into the Holiday Inn Express in Haupoge with her boyfriend slash manager. The term manager is used loosely. He scheduled her clients, took a cut. Some say he pressured her. Others say he protected her. But one thing is clear. On the night she vanished, he wasn't there. Surveillance footage shows Megan leaving the hotel just after 1:30 a.m. alone. She told the front desk she was stepping out briefly. She never returned. I walked that hallway myself, room 214. Still operational. The staff doesn't talk about her anymore. But the carpet is the same. The cameras still hum. The neon vacancy sign still buzzes with indifference. I stood in front of the mirror where Megan fixed her lipstick that night, trying to look professional, even calm. But I can only imagine what she felt inside. She was alone. Her disappearance was reported quickly. Her family back in Maine knew something was wrong. Her mom, Lorraine, raised hell, called every department she could reach. Haupog PD, Suffolk County, even tried the FBI, but the initial response was casual. She was flagged as high-risk lifestyle. Again, the same label, the same red tape that buries women alive. It wasn't until December 2010 that her body was found. Gilgo Beach, just yards from Maureen and Melissa, wrapped in burlap, strangled, positioned. There's a kind of surgical repetition here. A ritual. The killer wasn't just disposing of bodies. He was staging control. And Megan, she was the youngest of the first four. Her death wasn't isolated. It was strategic. According to my sources, some inside, some now whistleblowers, her case intersected with ongoing investigations into financial scams and illicit escort networks tied to offshore operations. That's right, offshore accounts. This wasn't just about sex. It was about money, control, movement, a web of exploitation that law enforcement tiptoed around because of its proximity to power. What happens when financial corruption and murder intersect? Nothing. Apparently, Megan's family was vocal. Her mother didn't back down. Lorraine became the face of grief weaponized into advocacy. She organized vigils, marched, demanded that the state stop treating her daughter like a statistic. She told the press, they treated her like she was nothing. But she was my baby, and she mattered. That quote has never left me. Because beneath the horror of Megan's murder is the heartbreak of how the system let it happen. By the time the investigation turned serious, Suffolk County had already made a mess of the evidence chain. Records lost, witnesses never followed up. There were whispers that Megan's phone had continued to ping near Massapequa, home of Rex Hoyerman. But the data, it couldn't be verified. Convenient. There's a moment when you stare at the raw files, the photos, the police reports, where you feel a knot in your stomach that doesn't go away. For me, it came when I saw a copy of Megan's hotel receipt. It was timestamped for 2:07 a.m. Just minutes after she stepped outside. She hadn't checked out. She hadn't packed her things. She thought she was coming back. That key card never left the room. I sat with Lorraine once, just once, at a coffee shop in Scarborough. She pulled a worn photo out of her wallet, Megan holding her daughter, mid-laugh, the kind of laugh that fills a room. She didn't get to finish her life, she said. Oh, and I didn't get to finish raising her. And that's the real tragedy, not just the crime, but the absence that follows it. Megan's story reveals something the headlines never touch. This killer didn't just take lives. He exploited loopholes in a system where women in the margins are punished for surviving. He thrived in the bureaucracy, in the silence, in the paperwork no one followed up on. He counted on it, and he was right. As I record this, the case against Rex Hoyerman is ongoing. He's been charged in Megan's murder. DNA and digital forensics finally caught up. But I don't know if that will ever be enough. Because even if he's convicted, the system that let her down is still intact. In the next chapter, we meet Amber Lynn Costello. She was bold, loud, funny, addicted. She set a trap to protect herself, but walked into one she didn't see coming. Her case is the clearest link to the man who may be the Long Island serial killer. But that night, she was still just a woman trying to survive, and the cost was everything. The trap that snapped shut Amber Lynn Costello didn't scare easy. She'd been through it all: addiction, abuse, arrests, overdoses, recovery, relapse, repeat. By the time she was 27, she'd lived 10 lives. But the last one ended in the hands of a man she never saw coming. They say she went out that night to trap a trick, but in truth, the trap was already set. And she wasn't the hunter, she was the prize. North Babylon, Long Island, September 2nd, 2010. Amber was last seen leaving her small rental house on America Avenue. It was run down, barely held together, but it was home. She shared it with roommates, some say friends, some say pimps, some say fellow survivors. That night, someone called her a new client. He had a specific request: no condom, high cash offer, pickup only. Amber didn't like the sound of it, so she staged a plan. According to reports and surviving witness testimony, Amber worked the setup with her roommate. The plan was simple: the client would arrive, knock, and she'd lure him inside long enough for the roommate to barge in, play angry boyfriend, and scare him off. They'd pocket the cash. No actual act, just fear and finesse. They'd pulled the move before. Only this time, he never came inside. He parked a few houses down, waited. Amber stepped out to guide him in. She never came back. The roommate claimed he looked through the blinds and saw her walking toward a dark-colored SUV. She waved, like she knew the guy. Then she disappeared from view. 10 minutes passed, then 20, then an hour. Panic didn't hit right away. Amber had vanished before binges, blackouts, jail holds. But this felt different. The next morning, her phone was dead, her bed untouched, her makeup bag still sitting open on the bathroom sink, and the trap they set, it snapped shut on the wrong target. I visited that house last year. It's still standing, boarded windows, cracked porch, a rotted swing still hanging on rusted chains. But if you press your ear to the air out there, it's like something lingers. Not ghosts, just grief. You can still smell the fear. Amber's remains were found in December 2010, Gilgo Beach, burlap wrapped, strangled, positioned like the others. But here's what makes her case critical. It gave investigators their first solid suspect profile. Why? Because someone had witnessed the man who came to pick her up. In July 2023, over a decade later, Suffolk County District Attorney's Office announced a major break. They arrested Rex Hoyerman, a 59-year-old architect from Massapequa Park. He was methodical, quiet, married, children. His wife was out of town during each killing. His internet history was a minefield of violence, torture, and snuff fantasies. What tied him to Amber? The phone calls, burner phones, and most damning of all, a witness sketch that looked just like him, all the way back in 2010. That sketch? It sat in a file under pending review for years. Red tape. Again. Amber's case had everything: a known timeline, witness statements, vehicle descriptions, a routine M. Oh, and yet, nothing happened for 13 years. You'd think with that much evidence, justice would have come faster. But when you live in a system where sex work equals silence, justice tales don't get finished. They just fade. Amber was loud, brash, funny, sarcastic, Her friends say she cracked jokes even when dope sickness took hold. They say she once told a trick. You better not be a serial killer unless you're paying extra. It was a joke, but it wasn't funny anymore. What haunts me most is this. Amber knew the game. She was street smart, a fighter. But even she couldn't outplay a predator who had the system rigged in his favor. He didn't need to be faster. He just needed to be invisible. And Rex Hoyerman was inside his home during the raid. Police found a vault. Not metaphorical. A real vault. Inside, dozens of burner phones, fake IDs, locked drives, and hidden among them, trophies, jewelry, hair ties, possibly from victims never even found. Amber's name was on one of those devices. They also traced offshore accounts, money funneled through fake shell companies, tied to encrypted transfers. It wasn't just about the murders. It was a network. Financial corruption woven into violence. A system within the system. And Amber unknowingly got too close. Her family barely got a funeral. There were no news specials. No vigils with candles on courthouse steps. Just a body, a name, and a silence they had to live with. Until now, Amber Lynn Costello deserves to be more than a footnote in a case that finally made headlines. She was the link, the risk, the warning that went unheard. And her story is the reminder. The Long Island serial killer wasn't just killing women. He was testing the system, finding out how far he could go before anyone would stop him. And for Amber, he got away with it for far too long. Next up, Jessica Taylor, a woman found in pieces. A case older than the rest, and a story buried deeper than even the others. Because Jessica's body wasn't just dumped, it was separated. And her killer? He made sure she stayed nameless as long as possible. The woman with no face. They called her Jane Doe, number 5. That's how I first met her, on paper. No name, no backstory. Just a partial corpse found in the woods of Manorville, New York, in July of 2003. Torso only. No head, no hands. They were taken, removed, deliberate. Whoever did this didn't want her to be found, but they didn't bury her. They posed her, as if even in death, she wasn't a person, just an object. A discard. That was Jessica Taylor, and it would take 8 years to reunite her name with her missing pieces. Jessica was 20 years old, a wanderer, a fighter, a woman scraping through a world that offered no safety net. She was originally from upstate New York, bouncing between foster homes and shelters. By 2003, she was working as an escort in Manhattan. She disappeared in July. She was last seen leaving the Port Authority bus terminal with a man never identified. Days later, her torso, tattooed with the words Remy and an image of a red heart with wings, was found in Manorville. The head, arms, and legs? Gone. It took until 2011, 8 years later, for her skull and remaining bones to be discovered in the marsh near Gilgo Beach. Same beach, same burial ground, same predator. The tattoo was the clue. That's how she got her name back. The ME released photos of the ink to the media. A woman in D. C. recognized it. Jessica had lived at a safe house she volunteered at. That ID cracked open the shell of mystery, but the core of what happened to her, still sealed. I've looked at the photos. Not the ones they show the public, the real ones. The ones with blue-lit crime scene tape flapping in the breeze. A pile of rotting leaves and a stretch of dirt too clean, too precise. That's where her body had been laid. Not dumped, arranged. And I know that kind of arrangement. I've seen it before. It's not just disposal. It's performance. He was sending a message. This wasn't just murder. It was a power display, a statement. He took away her face, her fingerprints, her legs. He made her as untraceable as possible, yet still visible. Left out in the open, like she didn't matter. But predators like this don't want invisibility. They want control. And when Jessica's skull turned up at Gilgo Beach, 8 years after the torso, they knew that it was the same man. Same patterns, same radius, same ritual. Jessica's case opened the theory that the Gilgo Beach killer may have been operating much longer than anyone first thought. Her murder wasn't 2010. It was 2003, and it wasn't sloppy. It was calculated. There was even some evidence. Plastic ties found nearby. A faded tarp, but none of it led anywhere. because by the time police realized Jessica Taylor was part of the same kill sequence, the trail was cold, and the killer had evolved. I spoke with an NYPD profiler who'd reviewed Jessica's file. Off record, of course. He told me the arrangement of the remains, the care, the restraint. It screamed one thing, an ownership. This wasn't someone afraid of getting caught. This was someone enjoying the bureaucratic failure that allowed him to kill with impunity. Someone who knew how to hide, because he knew the system wouldn't look too hard for women like Jessica. She'd been in and out of shelters. She'd been arrested once for solicitation. She had no fixed address, no insurance, no bank account. She existed in the grey zone, the place where true crime stories start and then disappear. She wasn't seen as a priority case. Her missing person's file was never even flagged. Because she didn't just vanish from a street corner, she vanished from a ledger. A line item lost under red tape. Jessica Taylor had dreams. I've read her intake forms from a halfway house in 2002. Under goals, she wrote, "Get my GED. Get my own apartment. Start over." Under fears, she wrote, "Getting stuck in this life forever." She didn't make it out. The media never ran her story the way they should have. Her mother died before ever knowing what happened. The system called her transient. The paperwork called her unidentified. But Jessica was never those things. She was failed by every structure designed to protect. And when the Gilgo case finally broke wide open in 2023, when the name Rex Hoyerman surfaced and the house in Massapequa was raided, Jessica's name wasn't even in the indictment. Not yet, because her murder, like others before and after, is still officially unsolved, still wrapped in a cloak of ambiguity, still dismissed. And so, here we are. Six women, six stories. Shannon, Maureen, Melissa, Megan, Amber, and Jessica. Different paths, same ending, same shadows of justice. But this story doesn't stop here. There are more victims, more Jane Does, more bones, more evidence ignored, buried, and redacted. And the man at the center, he lived like nothing happened. Built houses, raised children, bought guns, hid drives, opened offshore accounts. And the whole time, the system kept him hidden. In the final chapter, we connect the pieces. You'll hear about the child buried beside her mother, the Peaches case, the remains found far from Gilgo years earlier, but linked through DNA, through tattoos, through truths they didn't want uncovered. This next chapter is about all the nameless ones, the victims the headlines never mention, the ones who still don't have faces. But in this story, we're giving them names. Buried without a name, some victims die twice, once at the hands of a killer, and once again in the silence that follows. This is a story about the second death, the kind you don't see on television, the kind that doesn't get candlelight vigils, news conferences, or GoFundMe campaigns, the kind where a body is found, no ID, no press, no family contact, and quietly filed away, labeled, tagged, forgotten. Jane Doe, number 6. Jane Doe, number 7. Infant Doe, Peaches, and the names get colder, the numbers climb, and you start to wonder, how many bodies do we not know about? The Gilgo Beach case didn't begin with Shannon Gilbert, and it didn't end with Amber, Megan, Maureen, or Melissa. It didn't even end with Jessica Taylor, because long before headlines, before podcasts, before Rex Hoyerman's arrest, the bones were already waiting, and no one was listening. Let's start with Peaches. That was the nickname given to an unidentified woman found dismembered in 1997, years before the known Gilgo victims. Her torso was found in a Rubbermaid container at Hempstead Lake State Park. Her only identifier, a faded tattoo of a peach with two bite marks. That's what gave her the name, not a birth certificate, not a family, just ink. She was never reported missing. Her skull wasn't found until 2011. Buried near Gilgo Beach, and beside her, a child, a baby girl, around 2 years old. DNA confirmed it was Peach's daughter. Let that settle for a second. A killer buried a mother and child together years apart, like pieces in a sick puzzle. No name, no closure, no outcry. And then there's Karen Vergata. For over two decades, She was known as Fire Island Jane Doe. Her remains were found in 1996, skull fragments and foot bones. In 2011, more bones were discovered near Gilgo Beach. It wasn't until 2023, with new forensic technology, that her identity was confirmed. Karen Vergata, 34, last seen Valentine's Day, 1996. She had no digital footprint. No one filed a report. In the system, she didn't exist. This is what the killer exploited: gaps. He didn't just kill people. He selected people who were already fading from the public eye. Sex workers, runaways, women on probation, women who lived out of suitcases and under aliases. He understood something sickly brilliant. When society doesn't see you, your disappearance is not a headline, it's a formality. A bureaucratic hiccup, a missing body in a spreadsheet full of ignored trauma. And here's where the sickness deepens. Law enforcement knew there were more victims. They had the remains. They had the spacing. They even had matching disposal methods. Burlap. Shallow graves. Strangulation. But they stalled. They redirected. They treated these discoveries like separate cases. Why? Because admitting they were all connected meant admitting failure. Admitting that a serial predator had been operating for decades right under their nose. It meant someone had let this happen. The killer built an empire of silence, not just with his hand, but with our systems. He used burner phones to confuse digital trails, shell companies to hide transactions, offshore accounts to pay for services and vanish the money, and a public identity that no one would question. A quiet architect. A father. A neighbor. It worked, because he was never hunted like he should have been. He moved through the shadows of justice, cloaked by red tape and apathy. But here's the thing about shadows. Eventually, someone turns on a light. And when Rex Hoyerman was arrested in 2023, thanks to DNA, cell tower mapping, and a new task force finally willing to care, those shadows started shrinking, but not fast enough. There are still more victims out there. Still more bones. Still more names waiting to be spoken aloud for the first time. This chapter is their chapter. The voiceless, the vanished, the women and girls, and yes, even children who never made it home. They were not mistakes. They were not disposable. They were not just working girls. They were people. And they mattered. So now we close. Not with justice, but with memory. Let these names echo in your ears. Shannon Gilbert, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, Amber Lynn Costello, Jessica Taylor, Karen Vergata, Peaches, Infant Doe, and the others still waiting in the dark. Let their stories be more than tragedy. Let them be proof that silence kills, that red tape is lethal, and that when we fail to see someone in life, we often lose them in death.